cases, he can change his mind and take his wife back. There's one question which somebody asked here. Which version of the Bible is best to use against Christians? Really, rather not to use it against them, but use it to help them understand. As you know, some versions have large amounts of verses being taken out and books. Well, the Modern Standard Version, the Revised Standard Version, this is the most commonly used one. Between that and the King James Version, you can, the King James Version has all the verses initially. The Revised Standard, you have deleted verses. But in the Revised Standard, they indicate where the verses have been deleted. And this is actually a good one because you can use it to show them that their Bible has changed. You know, you've got deleted verses, which they said were once a part of the Bible for many hundreds of years. It was part of the Bible, and now we have deleted it. So this is something to, is useful to show them, you know, where changes, human changes have taken, you know, affected the Bible text itself. Tfadhali. Okay, this point is a point which we looked at earlier, that where a Christian says, I believe in Jesus because of the fact that my prayers were answered. I know it's the truth, Christianity is the truth because it has worked for me. Well, we can just give them the example of others. A person, a Hindu, who believes in Hinduism, he has his own personal god, Ganesh, the elephant head god, who he prays to. And his prayers are answered. Because surely, if Hindus prayed to their idols and their prayers were not answered, do you think they would continue to pray to their idols? Obviously, prayers are being answered. So we have to ask her, as a Christian, do you think that it is the elephant head god, Ganesh, who is answering her, those people's prayers? So what is she going to say? She's going to say yes? No. She will say, it must have been God. So then you say to her, that's the same thing. You're praying to Jesus, prayers are being answered, but that doesn't mean necessarily it is Jesus who answered it, any more than Ganesh answered the prayer of the Hindu. Well, you know, the issue of visions is the same thing. Hindus see visions, Buddhists see visions, all kinds of people see visions. We understand that these visions, it depends, a vision could be what we may call a true dream, where Allah shows something to somebody, you know, of the future, and it does happen, and these kind of things, and this is from Allah. Or they could be actual apparitions, where people, groups of people have seen Mary and the Christ child appearing before them, these kind of things, statues of Jesus with the, you know, tears coming from the eyes, and, you know, all these kind of things happening. And we know that the jinn are able to possess objects and things and give these kind of impressions to people. So this happens in all societies. It's not unique to Christian society. So if we're going to accept that as evidence of the truth of that, then we have to accept it for the other religions. Jesus being the begotten Son of God, what do they mean by that? Well, begotten means that one has been given birth to. That's what begotten means. Born of. Right? Which takes it away from symbolism, meaning literally, God gave birth to that Son. That's why they say the only begotten Son of God. Son of God, they say, okay, yes, God referred to many. Adam is a son of God, you know, and a number of others. But begotten Son, they restrict it to Jesus. However, even the term begotten has been used in the Old Testament with regards to others besides Jesus. And for us, as we said before, our response to that is, what do gods have? How do we deal with the issue of the modernist orientalists? Are they both of the same kind? How do we give them da'wah? Well, the modernist, meaning a person who wants to give a modern interpretation of Islam, Islam for the 20th century, we have to point out to them that Islam is for all times. That what Allah has prescribed, if it's right, if it is the final message, then it is for all times. This is what makes Islam unique. If it is about changing and modifying Islam, then what's the difference between Islam and Hinduism and the other isms that are constantly modifying themselves? Right? So it loses its uniqueness. If we will modernize Islam, it loses its uniqueness. It loses its divine purity. It is now becoming defiled, because once human beings step in and start to make changes, then they're making changes according to their own interpretations, which are limited and will make mistakes. So they're introducing mistakes into the system of Islam. Hadith, all my ummah will be forgiven except those who speak about their sins. What about somebody who is giving da'wah and talking about their previous life prior to Islam? They mention, I used to drink and fornicate, etc. Is this included in this? Well, if one explains this, or elements of this, one doesn't need to go into details. You know, one can say, well, you know, I was like everybody else, doing similar things, you know, that young people do of this time or whatever. Better to talk in general terms than to go into specifics, you know. And this is where it has some benefit. You're trying to relate to an audience, let them know that you didn't live in a place where these things didn't exist, so you're well aware of it, so you use it from that perspective. Otherwise, if it's not needed, then it's better to avoid it. And the main idea behind that is that for a person to speak about sins and specifics, then you're talking to an audience that may not be involved in those things, and now you've put it in their heads. You know, so it's better to keep whatever. And that's why, you know, if you have a bad thought, an evil thought, even a bad dream, Prophet ﷺ said, don't tell anybody. You have an evil dream, a bad dream, scary dream, whatever, don't go relate it to other people, because then you're introducing thoughts into their heads and then it messes them up. You know? So you limit it, you ask Allah's forgiveness, protection, and keep it to yourself. A revert sister finding it hard to practice Islam, is it okay for her to carry out the fard obligations and not the sunnah? Yes. The fard obligation, the fard, which is the obligation, this is what is required of her. The sunnah is additional. So that's what we're encouraged to do. That's additional reward. If a person, even if they weren't having difficulty, if they decided, today I'm not, you know, after Fajr I'm in a hurry, I'm not going to do my, after Dhuhr, for example, I miss sunnahs after Dhuhr, or, you know, after Isha or whatever, due to some other things I have to do, there's no sin. There's no sin on it. You know, people sometimes mistakenly teach that, for example, Isha is like 17 rak'at or something like this, you know. So people are learning, you know, the prayer as being, but really Isha is 4 rak'at. That's what Isha is. All of the others are voluntary prayers which you may do for additional reward, Or if you didn't do it, there's no sin against you. Isha is 4 rakat. Maghrib is 3. Asr is 4. Dhuhr is 4. And Fajr is 2. That's the bottom line. And we know a man came to the Prophet ﷺ and asked him, what is on me? The Prophet ﷺ said, you have 5 prayers in a day. And if you wish, you can do additional prayers. And the man said, no, I'll just deal with the 5 in the day. Then he went on to say to him, then you have the fasting of Ramadan. And if you wish to do, the man said, okay, I'll deal with the fasting of Ramadan. He went on through the different fard requirements. And each time the Prophet ﷺ began to express a sunnah, the man stopped him. And then at the end of it, the man said, okay, that's it. He said, yes. He said, I'll do no more and no less. And then he left. As he was turning away, the Prophet ﷺ turned to the other companions and said, he will enter paradise if he's truthful. He will enter paradise if he's truthful. So it means that if you do the basic fard requirements, then that is a guarantee. Doing it, of course, sincerely with all the other issues concerning it, that is a guarantee for paradise. That is the basic requirement. So, dawah in Africa, where there is a lot of culture mixed in with religion. I mean, this is not Africa. This is Asia. This is everywhere in the world today for Muslims. Chechnya, you know, Bosnia. Muslims all over the world have their Islam mixed up with culture so much so that people are hardly able to distinguish what is culture and what is Islam. What do we do in those circumstances? We have to try to bring people back to the Quran and the Sunnah. Get them to go back and to read and to understand the deen from the Quran and the Sunnah. If we get them to learn the deen from those sources, then that will give them a foundation to correct up the cultural baggage which they have inherited and which is blocking them from implementing certain aspects of Islam. Okay, question, what is the ruling about music in Islam? Actually, this is in the book, one of the topics that we should have covered, but we didn't have time to. I'll just say briefly that the basic ruling on music in Islam is that it is halal. Basic ruling on music in Islam is it is halal. But certain types of music are haram. Unfortunately, that type of music, which is haram, is the most popular music today. You see, this is where people get this idea, Islam is forbidding everything. You know, everything we like to do is haram. Well, actually, the majority of things are halal. And the things which are forbidden are few. This is very important when people bring this thing to us, you know, say, everything is haram for you guys. No. Everything is halal for us, except for a few things. You know, it's the issue of, as they say, looking at the glass as being half empty or half full. Right? For us, the vast majority of things are halal. For every haram thing, there are thousands of halal things. But what happens is that shaitan has made the haram things the things that people feel I have to do. My life is incomplete without doing this haram. Right? You know, it becomes the most attractive, the most pleasurable, the whatever. You know, it seems like that's where all the fun is, in the haram. You know, reality is that the halal is huge and there's way more fun there. But we have just been indoctrinated. We have been, you know, brainwashed by the media, the society, that this is where the fun is. So, music of today, we're talking about Madonna, Michael Jackson, you know, and all those types of things. All those, the common music, even classical music, you know, Bach, Beethoven. People say, oh, but Bach, Beethoven, and we can understand Madonna and Michael Jackson, but Bach, Beethoven, you know, this is Very, you know, but hey, Bach, Beethoven was the rock music of the 15th century. Huh? It's just times have changed and people are not doing what they used to do to it. But in those days, that was the dance music. They were doing their dances and, you know. So the point is that wind and stringed instruments, the Prophet ﷺ forbade wind and stringed instruments. So where the music is produced by the voice, singing, or by the duff, which is like a hand drum, this is permissible. Anything beyond that, the hand drum just produces what? A beat. Gives it some kind of tempo. Whereas the voice produces the musical element. And the Prophet ﷺ had said, "Man lam yataghanna bil Quran falaysa minna." Whoever doesn't sing the Quran is not of us. So we understand singing is halal, and we know so many other evidences. So the point is that music is permissible, but a certain element of it has been made forbidden. And it is because of the quality that that element has in captivating the hearts. It captivates the heart. It is the Quran of Shaitan, Satan's Quran. And when it captivates the heart, then it blocks that element, that part of the heart, from accepting the Quran of Allah. So this is what? There's a struggle over the hearts there. Can a woman travel to another country without a mahram in order to do aid work or voluntary work in the service of Islam, i.e. da'wah to women or to teach Quran to children, etc.? One has to again look at, you know, what you're asking here is, do the ends justify our means? Because we want to do this good thing, which is da'wah to women, teach the Quran, will that justify us doing something which has been identified as haram? No. We don't function like that. If there are other options, we go and try to find those other options. Otherwise, I'm sure, in the country that you're in, there's place for da'wah to women, and place to teach children Quran. You know? So it's not to say that the only way I can give da'wah to women and teach Quran is if I make, you know, I take a journey to another part of the world, etc., to do it. No. It's not the only way. So Allah has forbidden the women from traveling for a reason. Why? Is it because He doesn't want women to teach women Islam, make da'wah to them, and teach children Quran? No, of course not. He wants to protect them from harm. There is danger in journey, in traveling. So a woman traveling alone is in even greater danger. This is the point. It's for her protection. No more, no less. Sister is giving da'wah alongside brothers on the same da'wah table. Well, Islamically, I mean, of course, and they're saying basically these people are not mahrams, you know. It's better to have two tables, you know, two tables, one for brothers and one for sisters. So if women come, then the brothers can direct them over to the sisters, and if brothers come to the sisters, they direct them over to the brothers. That is better. Could you please explain what happened to Surah Rajam, which was not included in the Quran? Well, it's not Surah Rajam, but the verse on Rajam. It's the verse on stoning, or Umar ibn al-Khattab talked about. And Allah removed the text from the Quran, as He said that He would, يَمْحُ اللَّهُ مَا يَشَىٰ. Allah will remove from the Quran what He wishes, and He will affirm what He wishes. This is a part of the abrogatory process which Allah had with the Quran. Some verses were deleted and their ruling was deleted. Some verses were deleted and their ruling was kept. Some verses were kept and their ruling was deleted. These are just different ways in which Allah, you know, did abrogation in the Quran. What made you interested in Islam? Huh? And what type of da'wah worked on you? For myself, briefly, I was into communism. I was a communist in university at the time when I decided to become a Muslim. However, though I was a communist, I had become disenchanted with communism after working with the Communist Party for a number of years. And I started looking elsewhere. And alhamdulillah, a friend of mine actually from the Communist Party had accepted Islam. And when she accepted Islam, she got married to a Muslim brother, it caused me to want to look at Islam, and I asked for some material. I started reading Towards Understanding Islam by Maududi, and the second book I read was Islam, the Misunderstood Religion by Muhammad Qutb, and that book convinced me from a political level that Islam was the right way. You know, it was a comparative study of Islam, communism, Christianity, socialism, etc. And from looking at that comparison, I was convinced that Islam had the answers. All the good that was in communism, all the good that was in Christianity, etc., etc., it was there in Islam. But belief in God for me took some time after that. Because after having lived 4 years, 5 years denying God's existence, you don't just turn around one day like flipping a switch and all of a sudden you believe in God again. You know, so it took me some time of reflection, and Allah gave me some personal signs in my life that He existed. And following that, then I accepted Islam. And people had been telling me different little things about Islam. I'd run into people at different occasions. But for me, as I said, that particular book, Towards Understanding Islam, was a good presentation. But what convinced me was the Islam, the Misunderstood Religion.